This is the NPR News Update for Tuesday, April 9th. News on your schedule. I'm Perry Finelli. State lawmakers this week will consider a new proposal to help fund a Viking stadium. Lawmakers are also reconsidering plans for a gas tax increase after Governor Mark Dayton again reiterated his opposition to the proposal. And some rural Minnesota school administrators are concerned students won't do as well on spring assessment tests because of the number of snow days they took this year. Another potential backup funding source for the new Viking Stadium may make its debut in the State House Taxes Committee this week. Ann Lencheski chairs the committee. She is proposing adding a sales tax to sports-themed clothing, which currently is not taxed. She would also add a tax to luxury suites and other premium stadium seating at all Minnesota sports stadiums. Vikings spokesman Lester Bagley says the team has not fully considered the bill's impact. He says the team does not want to renegotiate the deal they struck with the state last spring.
Part of that agreement was the assurance that there would be no additional taxes on stadium revenues going forward. So we're focused on our contribution, our guarantee, and our financing of the $477 million.
The Vikings will pay about half the cost of the new stadium. The state and the city of Minneapolis will pay the rest. DFL legislative leaders are reconsidering their plan to increase the state gas tax after Governor Mark Dayton signaled his opposition. Tom Scheck reports.
The chairs of the House and Senate Transportation Committees delayed the release of their transportation bills and abruptly canceled a news conference after Governor Dayton said he wasn't on board.
I don't support a gas tax. I don't think the people of Minnesota are prepared to support it, and that's the critical consideration.
DFL Representative Frank Hornstein of Minneapolis says DFLers will work with Dayton on how to find more money for roads, bridges, and transit projects.
It'd be premature to sort of take anything off the table at this point, and we're really committed to having a balanced bill and moving forward. But again, we want to make sure that we're moving forward together.
Dayton is supporting a metro-wide sales tax increase for transit, but Hornstein said it will be difficult to pass that unless more money is found for roads and bridges. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
State lawmakers will announce proposals this week to help pay for expanding mass transit in the Twin Cities. East Metro officials are watching the action very closely. They have renewed efforts to advance a wish list of bus and rail lines to help the East Metro catch up to the West. Jess Mador reports.
Shoppers hustle to their cars outside Walmart just off I-94 in Woodbury. Soon, they could hop on a rapid bus or light rail line with their groceries instead. Washington County Commissioner Lisa Weick says the transit line is still in the early stages. Planners think a station could go in right across from this Walmart.
Because there's more business development along here and the transit improvements would support additional commerce.
The proposed Gateway line would run as bus or light rail between downtown St. Paul and Woodbury and then on to Wisconsin. Projections show Gateway attracting up to 10,000 riders a day when it opens in about 10 years. Weick says the line will provide much-needed transportation for the fast-growing city of Woodbury. Right now, buses run only during rush hours without weekend or evening service.
And so to just have commuter buses in the morning and in the afternoon is really an issue that I hear about a lot when I'm out in the communities. It's probably one of the top concerns among my constituents is to have additional mobility options.
The proposed Gateway line is one of several mass transit projects in the works for the East Metro. It's the farthest ahead. Federal funding for transit like this is extremely competitive. Cities with projects that are most advanced in terms of planning are more likely to get that federal money. The West Metro has not one, but two new mass transit projects ready to move forward. There was a time when the East Metro was also farther along. Several decades ago, there were plans for a light rail line that would have connected downtown St. Paul with Minneapolis, St. Paul International Airport, and the Mall of America. Those plans fell apart, and instead, Minneapolis got the Twin Cities' first light rail line, Hiawatha. And next year, the Central Corridor light rail line begins operations between downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis.
You know, timing is everything.
Ramsey County Commissioner Rafael Ortega remembers the original fight for a line from downtown St. Paul to the airport. He says there's more appetite for transit in the East Metro now, even among former opponents. And recently, the city of St. Paul and Ramsey County agreed to resume studying it. But Ortega says the East Metro faces hurdles the West Metro doesn't when it comes to building out transit. Most West Metro transit lines run entirely within Hennepin County. Not so for the East Metro.
You're talking multiple counties, dozens of cities. We have to build consensus. But in the long run, the fact that we have to work with others and get agreement just ties the communities closer together moving into the future.
Ortega wants to see St. Paul take a leadership role in pushing for more transit. That was the idea last month when St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman revived a transit alliance to secure more investment for the East Metro. The group's co-director, Matt Kramer, says one of its goals will be to finally complete the airport triangle and build out the rest of the system. By not building the St. Paul link years ago, Kramer says the East Metro is behind.
By not being first, we didn't fall to second place. We didn't fall to third place. We didn't even fall to fourth place. Fifth place at best, and we still have to make the case.
Despite growing calls for more transit in the East and West metros, the question is how to pay for it. In his revised budget, Governor Mark Dayton proposed an additional transit-dedicated sales tax of a half cent to pay for almost two dozen projects. The new tax would be mandatory for all seven metro counties. Right now, just five counties contribute. Lawmakers are expected to announce their own transportation funding proposal later this week. Jess Mador, Minnesota Public Radio News.
For the first time, Governor Mark Dayton included the Minnesota Children's Museum in his bonding proposal. Conrad Wilson has that story.
Dayton has proposed $14 million for the St. Paul Museum. The Minnesota Children's Museum plans an expansion that would cost a total of $28 million. Diane Kreizand is the museum's president. She says the gallery space would increase by 50%.
Our visitors tell us that crowding is actually the biggest reason that they don't come more often. And so we have the opportunity to expand in the space that we're already at in downtown St. Paul.
According to the museum's 2012 annual report, more than 432,000 people attended the museum. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
This is the NPR News Update, available every day around noon. Minnesota's news on your schedule. Ecolab says it has resolved U.S. Justice Department concerns about the company's $2.2 billion deal for a Texas firm in the oil and gas industry. Martin Moreland reports.
Last October, Ecolab agreed to acquire Champion Technologies, which helps energy companies tap oil and gas deposits that are harder to access and require more processing to remove impurities. But the Justice Department said combining Champion with Nalco, a prior Ecolab acquisition, would combine two of the leading providers of chemical management services for deepwater wells in the Gulf of Mexico. To address antitrust concerns, Ecolab will divest some Champion technology and assets. Piper Jaffray analyst Michael Ritzenthaler says Ecolab gets most of what it wants.
It seems like Ecolab's strategy driving their acquisition of Champion, namely increased exposure to things like oil field production chemicals and water treatment, is untouched.
Ecolab says the settlement affects only about 3% of Champion's business. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Low-fare Spirit Airlines has added daily nonstop service between the Twin Cities and Dallas-Fort Worth. Spokeswoman Mindy Pinson says the airline sees a good opportunity to win over travelers on the route.
There's a lot of people that are interested in traveling between Dallas-Fort Worth and Minneapolis-St. Paul. And it's a market where right now fares are currently pretty high, and Spirit is known for its ultra-low fares, so we're looking forward to bringing an ultra-low fare option to that market.
Spirit does charge fees for some things that other airlines do not, however. For instance, the airline charges $25 or more for carry-on bags that don't fit under a seat. Sun Country, Delta, and American Airlines also fly to Dallas-Fort Worth nonstop. This will be Spirit's fifth nonstop destination from Minneapolis-St. Paul. Minnesota produced more than a billion gallons of ethanol last year, making it the fifth largest ethanol maker in the country. Much of that production was spurred on by a federal requirement known as the Renewable Fuel Standard, or the RFS, which took effect in 2007. That standard requires that ethanol be blended with gasoline. But the Renewable Fuel Standard is coming under new scrutiny in Congress. Brett Neely reports.
The issue that's prompting this reevaluation is something known in the ethanol industry as the blend wall. The renewable fuel standard requires increasing amounts of ethanol to be mixed in with the gasoline supply, currently 10%. But those standards were written in 2007, and no one forecast that Americans were about to start driving less or that their cars were about to become more fuel efficient. So Purdue energy economist Wally Tyner says refiners are being asked to mix increasing amounts of ethanol into a shrinking pool of gasoline.
By 2014 or 2015, we literally will not be able to blend as much corn ethanol as the renewable fuel standard requires.
In other words, the industry will hit that blend wall. One way to keep meeting the standard would be to expand the use of fuels that contain 15% or more ethanol. The problem with those blends is that cars made before 2001 and most gasoline engines that power boats, chainsaws, and generators can't use fuels with that much ethanol. And gas stations have been reluctant to install separate pumps for the different kinds of fuels. That reluctance leads some ethanol advocates to blame the oil industry. Bob Dineen is the president of the Renewable Fuels Association, one of the ethanol industry's trade groups.
The blend wall is a creation of the oil company's own making.
No serious legislation to change or undo the renewable fuel standard has yet been introduced. But the House Energy and Commerce Committee is asking industry and environmental groups for feedback on the RFS in the coming months and is drafting a series of white papers on problems with the standard. Dineen says ethanol's rapid growth over the past decade is making big oil fearful and has prompted this congressional review.
Ethanol is now 10% of the barrel. It is growing. They don't want to lose any more market share.
The review comes at a time when ethanol has lost some of the political clout it once had on Capitol Hill. Unlike many issues in this divided Congress, opposition and support for ethanol tends to be based as much on geography as it is on ideology. The industry lost a big tax break at the beginning of 2012, and both political parties have signaled a willingness to roll back some crop subsidies for corn farmers. While ethanol production has been using as much as 40% of the nation's corn crop in recent years, last year's drought and high corn prices spurred by the ethanol boom have forced some ethanol plants to shut down. Though Dineen is eager to pin ethanol's challenges on the oil industry, other interest groups are also unhappy with the ethanol mandate.
Everything that we were sold in 2007 has turned out to be wrong.
Scott Faber is the top lobbyist for the nonprofit Environmental Working Group.
We haven't seen, you know, the environmental benefits that were promised. We haven't seen gas prices go down.
Faber's group points to studies showing that ethanol barely has any advantages over gasoline when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, and that high corn prices have encouraged farmers to put marginal environmentally sensitive land under cultivation. Livestock producers and food companies which use corn have also argued that the renewable fuel standard should be rolled back because the mandate has raised their costs. But even if all of those industries got what they wanted and eliminated the ethanol mandate, things might not change as much as they expect, says Tyner, the energy economist, because oil refiners have now gotten used to blending ethanol into gasoline and are unlikely to stop doing it.
The biofuels industry is a government-created industry. As it turns out, today, if the RFS went away for corn ethanol would stay, despite what the industry says.
This debate is going to take a while to play out. The House Energy Committee is likely to hold hearings on the standard this summer, with legislation possibly following in the fall. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The rush to mine frac sand in Minnesota and Wisconsin has slowed. Demand for the silica sand is not as strong as it was a couple of years ago. The sand is used to pull natural gas from the earth through hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which is happening in other states. Elizabeth Dunbar reports on what affects demand for frac sand and why several Minnesota companies are still eager to mine it.
Bill Bryan shakes silica sand out of one of the sandwich bags displayed on his desk to show different grain sizes.
These particles, if you really look close, are really round, and that's desirable.
Bryan's father and grandfather started Bryan Rock Products back in 1941. The company's primary business has been limestone products, but that could change because of what's underneath its limestone quarries in Shakopee.
When we'd drill too deep, we knew we'd hit sand. That's a chance for us to expand. It would add quite a few jobs for us, and yeah, it's exciting.
We walk down a crushed limestone slope to look into a pit of reddish-brown rock where Bryan hopes to start mining sand late this year. He's spent more than 2 years working through the environmental studies required to get mining permits.
There you can see the limestone face, yet to be mined.
The quarry is quiet at this time of year, especially because the company's sales have softened. With the drop in construction as a result of the housing bust, there's less need for the company's limestone for landscaping and driveways. Their sales are down by more than half. Brian hopes to add frack sand to the company's product line. His plan is to mine the sand, process it, and load it into rail cars, all right here. And he says the ability to do everything in one place will make the multi-million-dollar investment worth it. Many sand mines are forced to truck sand to other locations for processing and transport, which increases their costs.
The market has softened in the last year or two, and we've seen prices for a lot of things come down. We feel it's still a good, viable project, but you have to be a low-cost producer to maintain.
Those who track the frack sand mining industry are paying close attention to the upper Midwest because of the rich, easily accessible sand deposits. But they say transportation is an important question when evaluating whether a project is viable. Emma Hughes is deputy editor for Industrial Minerals, a London-based publication that analyzes the industrial minerals markets.
Companies like to mention this is how we're going to get it from A to B, and it's a big thing for them. It's not something people necessarily think of first and foremost, but actually it's probably one of the biggest problems they have to overcome.
How big a problem that is depends on how much demand there is for the sand. When demand is high, prices go up, and companies can afford some extra transportation costs. So what drives demand for sand?
We're going to need to see a more sustained increase in natural gas pricing. We're bumping around $4.
Stephen Ilke, an oil and gas industry consultant, says natural gas prices are a key factor. Right now, natural gas costs about $4 per million BTU. Ilke says he expects natural gas to reach $6 per million BTU by 2015, which he says would dramatically boost the number of rigs extracting the gas. And they're going to need a lot of sand. Even with companies in Minnesota and other states lining up to fill that future demand for frack sand, Ilke says not all of them will be able to get mines up and running.
There's going to be tremendous needs. I mean, I look at the mine projections and they're huge, but the reality is a lot of those mines won't get permitted. You know, a lot of them, if they get permitted, won't get financed. So when I look at future projections, I don't believe it because those mines are just not coming online.
Ilke says the industry is watching environmental regulations closely in both Wisconsin and Minnesota because obstacles like temporary bans on mining could impact how much sand is available for fracking. In Minnesota, DFL lawmakers are considering a frack sand production tax, as well as placing more environmental scrutiny on proposed mines. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News, Shakopee.
Anoka County prosecutors have charged a 24-year-old Andover man with third-degree murder of his girlfriend. According to the criminal complaint, Seth Adam Olson purchased and later gave methadone to his 39-year-old girlfriend in mid-February. The woman, also of Andover, died hours after taking the drug. Paul Young is division chief for violent crime in the Anoka County Attorney's Office. He says this type of homicide charge is increasing.
It's in response to a sort of an evolution that even though people may willingly choose to participate in the taking of the drugs, that there still has to be responsibility for those who provide them.
Last year, Minnesota saw the highest number of third-degree adult murder charges from overdose deaths in a decade. It was a tough winter across the state, and for many rural Minnesota school districts, that's resulted in lots of weather cancellations. While snow day may be one of the sweetest phrases any student can hear, they're a major headache for school administrators. Some school officials are worried all those closures this winter could end up hurting students' scores on high-stakes testing this spring. Tim Post reports.
Ask a rural Minnesota school superintendent how the winter was, and you won't get a rundown of the high and low temperatures, snow totals, or other meteorological facts. Superintendents measure a winter's strength in a different way.
We had a total of about 11 days where we either had late starts or an early out.
We've had 4 complete days that we've missed this year.
And I've had more school-related closings and late starts than I've had in my whole previous career as a superintendent.
Those superintendents from western Minnesota run districts like many in the state, rural and spread out across hundreds of square miles. Blizzards and ice storms can make it downright dangerous for buses to navigate their country roads, prompting officials to call off school altogether during bad weather. Most rural school districts can count on at least 1 or 2 snow days a year, but there have been so many this year that school leaders are worried how it will affect their students' performance on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Tests, or MCAs, in April and May. Montevideo Superintendent Luther Heller says teachers tell him they're behind in preparing students for MCAs.
We're very fearful that this will have an impact on how we perform on it, that we will have some students that won't do as well as they would have had we gotten all of the instructional time in that was possible to get in.
Because of the snow days, Heller has had to eliminate some of the district's scheduled days off so students can get more test preparation time. Other rural districts say they'll provide tutoring to students to get them ready for MCAs. And the Morris School District pushed some of its testing in May back by a week to give students and teachers time to catch up after the disruptions of several snow days and late starts. Craig Peterson is principal of Morris High School.
A week matters. I mean, 5 more days of instruction matters for our teachers. It matters for our kids.
These efforts show just how nervous school officials can get around the results of MCA tests. That's because the tests truly are high stakes. Older students need to pass the reading, writing, and math portions to get their diplomas, and schools themselves are judged on how well students perform on the tests. Charlene Briner, chief of staff at the Minnesota Department of Education, says that's why the state allows schools to give many of their tests in windows that range from March until May.
And those windows are designed to give districts flexibility because we recognize there can be floods, there can be snow days, there can be outbreaks of illness. And so we really want to offer an opportunity for districts to schedule the testing in a way that meets their needs.
Some Minnesota school leaders say something else would help them in years like this, the ability to start school before Labor Day. Montevideo Superintendent Luther Heller says that would give students more time to prepare for MCAs, especially in years with lots of school closures.
But even if a district were to be able to start 4, 5, 6 days earlier and get more instructional time in prior to the MCAs, that flexibility would be helpful.
Current law now requires schools to start after Labor Day, although 30 districts, including Minneapolis and 24 in southwest Minnesota, have special waivers to start early. A bill in the K-12 education omnibus bill at the Capitol this session would allow schools to start before the end of the summer holiday. The issue has come up many times before, but failed after opposition from the state's tourism industry. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The board of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra meets this afternoon to discuss the orchestra's future. The meeting comes after management and musicians missed a deadline to prevent the cancellation of the rest of the current season. Ewan Kerr has more.
After a day of letters and calls and attempts to prevent a loss of the rest of the orchestral season, interim SPCO President Dobson West quietly watched the clock tick down to the 5 p.m. deadline. It didn't look good.
There have been a number of discussions that have been going on. Unfortunately, none of them have led to a breakthrough.
First thing Monday morning, the SPCO Musicians Negotiating Committee rejected a management offer made Friday, saying it didn't resolve outstanding issues, including on internet and broadcast rights of SPCO performances. Instead, the musicians called upon management to consider their offer of April 2nd. Mayor Chris Coleman, who for the last 3 weeks has been trying to broker a deal, then urged the musicians to reconsider the rejection, saying he believed all their concerns were covered in the management's latest offer. Dobson West weighed in with a letter of his own, rejecting the musicians' April 2nd proposal as he did last week, saying it added hundreds of thousands of dollars in extra expense. After all that activity, the 5 p.m. deadline came and went quietly. West says now it's time for the SPCO board to consider its options at a meeting this afternoon.
We will be in executive session and we will be looking at all the alternatives that are available in front of us given where we are today with respect to these negotiations.
West has said recently one of those alternatives may be to suspend operations. The contract conflict has prevented the announcement of the 2013-2014 season, and the orchestra has not been able to sell subscriptions or tickets. It's also hampering fundraising. The musicians are also discussing what to do next. Musician negotiator Carol Mason-Smith says musicians will likely issue a formal statement today after caucusing about what happened at various meetings on Monday. She believes the season is still salvageable and that the musicians' proposal continues to make the most sense.
We do still remain hopeful that the management will accept our current offer, which includes money saved through the 22-week lockout, will save this management more than $5 million by the end of June 2016.
Another group watching the developments closely is Save Our SPCO, a group originally formed to try to bridge the gap between the two sides, but has now become firm supporters of the musicians. The group's John Eisenberg describes himself as an audience advocate and says that audience is not happy.
You know, the audience members are feeling hurt and angry and frustrated, but we also know that what we're going through probably pales in comparison to what the musicians are going through.
Eisenberg says the group's exploratory committee to create an alternative administration for a world-class chamber orchestra in St. Paul held its first meeting last night. The aim is to produce a support structure for musicians should a deal at the SPCO fall through. Eisenberg says, however, Monday, April 8th, 2013 may be remembered as an important day for the orchestra.
Certainly if this rest of the season is canceled and the management does what they threatened to do, which is to suspend operations, then certainly this would be a pivotal day or a black letter day in SPCO history.
When all is said and done, in a final note of the day to SPCO supporters, interim SPCO President Dobson West did not actually announce the cancellation of the season. Instead, he promised what he described as, quote, formal announcements of next steps to follow this afternoon's meeting. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, the Ordway Center for the Performing Arts has announced the 2012 Sally Awards, honoring special achievement by Minnesota artists. Marianne Combs reports.
Each year, the Sally Awards recognize five individuals or organizations for their contributions to the state's cultural life. This year's Commitment Award went to Anthony Capone, the founder of the 60-acre Capone Art Park in Eagan. Pillsbury House directors Faye Price and Noel Raymond received the Initiative Award for infusing the arts into every aspect of their Minneapolis Neighborhood Community Center. Mentoring Peace Through Art founder Jimmy Longoria got the Vision Award for teaching youth to create murals that deter gang graffiti. Hillcrest Community School in Bloomington was honored with the Education Award for integrating the arts into math, science, and social studies. And David Frere, CEO of Arts Midwest, won the Arts Access Award for sharing the work of Minnesota artists throughout the United States. Marianne Combs, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Perry Vanelli. Thanks for listening.